there. Welcome to We Need to Talk, a podcast that helps empower each of us. And I'm the host, Jane Hasler, a sociologist, mental health professional, and mother of eight, seven sons and one daughter, who range in age from 16 up to 33 years. Each episode, I'm talking with an expert on a particular social issue, from mental health to climate change, from pornography to bullying. Knowledge is power, so let's get started. This episode, I'm talking with Marie Crabb, an author, filmmaker, and educator, about pornography and the harm it causes, particularly to children, adolescents, and young adults. Marie is director of the Australian Violence Prevention Initiative, It's Time We Talked. She co-produced and directed the documentary film Love and Sex in an Age of Pornography, which has been broadcast in 36 countries. For the well-being of our society as a whole, we need to understand the negative impact from porn, which alarmingly makes up one-third of all internet traffic. Hello, Marie Crabb. Thank you so much for joining We Need to Talk today to discuss such an important topic, pornography. First up, I wanted to ask you, Marie, I'm 50 plus 10, I can't even say that number at the moment, but when I was a teenager, pornography in those days was really just about a dirty magazine. Why is it so different nowadays? Why is it such a crucial issue that we need to address nowadays?
So I think there are two reasons why it's different now. One is how easy it is to access, and the other is the kind of content that children and young people are exposed to has shifted as well. So in terms of its ease of access with the internet, pornography has grown enormously. It's a massive global industry. Just recently, porn sites accounted for three of the top 10 most viewed websites in the world. So that puts them under Facebook and Google, but above things like Amazon, eBay, Netflix. And young people come across it on purpose sometimes. You know, they might be out of curiosity or because their friends are talking about it, because they want to learn how to have sex, to deal with boredom. You know, there's lots of reasons that young people give for looking at it on purpose, but they're also exposed to it at really high rates unintentionally. So porn is marketed really aggressively online. Explicit pop-ups just appear uninvited on the screen, or they might be playing a game and it turns into pornography, even a children's game. They might be searching for something like their favorite cartoon character, Frozen, or, you know, anything, and porn might appear, or they might be sent a link by a friend or a partner or a peer or, you know, a complete stranger. So for many young people, it's actually more difficult to avoid it than it is to see it. And some recent research in Australia with just under 2,000 young people found that almost half, 48% of boys have seen pornography by the age of 13, and almost half of girls have seen it by the age of 15. And wow. It also, the study also found that particularly young men, a significant portion, over half of them, are watching it weekly or more often. 56% said they're using it weekly or more often. And about one in six, or 17%, said they're watching it daily or more often. So it's really incredibly accessible, whether they want to see it or not. It's out there. That's the first reason that it's different. And the second reason, yeah, really is around the kind of content they're likely to see. They're not seeing a picture in a magazine like pornography used to be. They're not just seeing images of people having sex. They're seeing mountains sometimes, you know, of high definition images that regularly depicts aggression. And, you know, the aggression in pornography is almost always directed towards women, 94-97% of the time. Different studies find different numbers, but it's almost always against women. Yeah. And it suggests that sex is, you know, something you don't need to negotiate consent about, that it's something where men should play these dominant, aggressive, controlling roles and women should be submissive and very happy to do whatever men want to do. Even when the characters in it are not, you know, where it's gay or lesbian porn or trans porn, there's often a kind of aggressive character and a submissive character. So these kinds of messages that we know underpin gender-based violence are normalized and reinforced in pornography. I mean, there's lots more to say about what porn depicts, about bodies, about sexual safety, about pleasure, you know, particular practices that it normalizes, including dangerous practices like choking or strangulation. But they're the two key reasons. It's everywhere, it's hard to avoid, and what they're seeing is conveying deeply problematic messages about sex, but also about gender, aggression, power.
Wow. So it's actually being used, isn't it, as an educator in a way, isn't it? It's the main educator of teenagers in relation to sexual relations. Would you say that?
Yes, I think it's become a kind of default sexuality educator for many young people growing up online. And that's because they are absorbing the messages from it. You know, they're often seeing it. On average, young men are seeing pornography 3 years before their first sexual experience, and young women are seeing it 2 years before their first sexual experience.
So what age are we talking about?
So 13 for boys on average and 15 for girls on average.
Wow.
And, okay. You know, and then they're not having their sexual experiences for some time after that. But for particularly for young men, they may have absorbed messages over dozens or hundreds or even thousands of hours of, you know, consuming pornography before they've had sex with someone and perhaps before they've kissed someone or touched their skin. So it's really playing a role in terms of the kind of setting of norms and shaping of sexual tastes. Young people are also actively using pornography as a source of information about relationships and sex. So the Australian study, which was conducted by Our Watch, the National Foundation for the Prevention of Violence Against Women and Their Children, found that 60% of 15 to 20-year-old males and 41% of 15 to 20-year-old females used pornography as a source of information about relationships and sex in the last 12 months, not ever, but just in the last 12 months. And they did so even though most of them said they thought it was neither realistic nor a good place to learn about sex.
That is a massive concern, isn't it, Marie? I mean, the situation is that it's becoming rougher, isn't it, and more aggressive, would you say? It has been coming more so over the last decade or two decades. And reading what I've read, a lot of directors, producers in that industry say that rough sex sells. And that is a really sad indictment of our society. What do you say about that?
Yes, we've conducted interviews with people in the porn industry, particularly in the US, but also in Hungary. So producers, performers, directors, executives and agents, and also read, you know, a fair bit of research about these issues. And I think part of what producers and directors said to us and performers is that rough sex is what sells. And part of that is because they are operating in an enormous marketplace. So before the internet, the porn industry made a couple of hundred films every year. And since the internet, and certainly since the internet's become more accessible, where anybody with a little video recorder or even a good quality phone can become a porn producer, producers need to find an angle that will sell in that enormous marketplace. And they're making, you know, thousands upon thousands of new videos every year. And the way the algorithms work is that, you know, the way the porn industry makes money is by getting you to either buy content or to watch their content so that they can make money from advertising and potentially from gathering your data and selling it on. And so the longer they can hold your attention, the better chance they have of getting you to buy something and of getting that advertising revenue. And so one of the ways to maintain people's attention is to feed them content that is more eye-catching, which might be shocking, disturbing, alarming content.
Yes.
We see this not just in pornography, of course, but in social media, the way the algorithms work to take you down a rabbit hole, maintain your attention, you know, try to anticipate through quite complicated algorithms what you may or may not like and keep pushing you. So the content has become more aggressive and deliberately more aggressive towards women. Mainstream pornography, I'm not talking about marginal pornography, but totally mainstream pornography. It also has, mainstream pornography also includes themes like incest or family themes. Stepmom, stepbrother, stepsister, mum and son, you know, what all sorts of different themes.
But yes, children, you know, child porn.
There is, certainly child sexual exploitation material is available, but, you know, adult content that is considered to be by many a legitimate form of sexual exploration includes content that is incest themed. And this is on the home pages of the most popular sites. It's not stuff you have to go searching for. It's if you look up porn and click on any of the most popular sites, then you're going to see incest themed porn. And I think often many parents are not aware that that's the kind of content to which children and young people are exposed.
Yes, that's true. Going back to the directors and the producers, did any of them express regret about that's the way it is, but they're saying, oh, it was unfortunate, they felt they had to go down that path?
I don't think any of our interviewees expressed regret about that being the reality, but many of them expressed that that is the case. You know, this is what the customers want. They love it. They buy the movies when this is what it's like. And this, you know, pornography is an industry. It is a big, big business. And so I think that it's not just that this is what the customers want. I think it's also that the industry feeds that content because it suits them, particularly in the online environment. It, like I said, it captures people's imagination. It, you know, shocks them. It creates that sort of adrenaline rush or the dopamine rush that can kind of keep someone's interest. So, you know, I think your average 13-year-old boy, when he first looks up porn, I don't think very many of them are interested in seeing women being gagged and choked and spanked.
Oh, God, no.
They're interested in sex and maybe breasts and bodies and women, and, you know, that would be a normal and healthy part of adolescent development. But what they see is often content that is, you know, quite aggressive and very gendered in its aggression, and things like non-consent and racism. I think that then starts to be what seems normal because that's what you see. So it's a bit chicken and egg, you know, the industry's making content that its customer base wants, that's what they pay, and there's apparently significant numbers of largely men around the world who want to see gendered aggression, sexualized gendered aggression. But then they also are creating the customer base by creating this kind of content and marketing it heavily, and then people start to sort of get a sense that this is what sex is like.
Mm. Going back to the word absorbed, you know, young kids absorbing this. I mean, we have to think about the neural pathways, don't we? I mean, they almost become desensitized to this aggression. And then, as you said, it's almost a catch-22, a chicken and egg, where they want more and more and more to feed their desire of what they're watching, more aggression, more violence. So would you say that there is a component there of the neural pathways being affected at that really sensitive age, you know, when they're adolescents, when they're coming into adolescence?
Look, I think for any of us, if we were to consume pornography regularly or any form of media, it can shape our neural pathways, and particularly if we're masturbating to and creating that sort of physiological feedback loop that says this is pleasurable, you know, this content's pleasurable, it becomes a pattern where we're laying down those neural pathways. But yes, for young people, it's a very important time developmentally when they are learning, you know, their understanding of the world, of other human beings, of themselves, their own sexuality. And I think it's really very sad that many young people are having their sexual tastes shaped not by their own explorations with a similar aged peer or maybe someone they like or even love, but you know, but by a global multi-billion dollar industry that doesn't have their interest at heart, that has their profits at heart. So yes, I think consumption of pornography, and particularly repeated consumption of pornography, it can and does lay down neural pathways that shape desire, taste, expectations, and then ultimately experiences. And I've conducted a lot of interviews with young people about their own sexual experiences and the way that it's been shaped by the porn they've seen or the porn that their partners and peers have seen, because you don't need to be a consumer of pornography to have it shape your sexual experiences. If your partner has watched porn and they've watched potentially a lot of porn, then you know, a lot of young women describe this. A lot of heterosexual young women describe that their male partners have seen porn. The young women don't know what they're doing. So the young men are initiating things they've seen in porn. And often they are not things that feel good for those young women, but it's become the script.
It has, very unfortunately, it has become the script in relation to a lot of girls, how they're depicted, how the females are depicted in porn. It shows that the performers actually desire being treated like that. And that can inform not only gender expectations around masculinity, but around femininity. And so a lot of the males have found that, or they believe that a lot of women like to be treated that way. Would you say that's the case?
Yes. So there's a study that was conducted by some US researchers that found that almost every act of aggression in pornography is met with either a neutral or a pleasured or positive response. So they actually found that 95% of incidents of aggression was met with that sort of positive or, you know, neutral response by the target of the aggression. So the message to the viewer is that girls and women like it when men gag them, choke them, spank them, you know, behave aggressively towards them. And I think that those messages are certainly being absorbed by consumers of pornography. But young women are also saying to us that they are internalizing those messages, even if they're not a big consumer of pornography, because there's a sense of this is what good sex looks like, and you get sort of more validation from a male partner if you're seen to not only be willing to do these things but to behave as though you enjoy doing them. So I think that it creates a very challenging environment for young women to explore what might genuinely feel pleasurable for them, because they're having their sexuality shaped by porn and by their partners, and there's not a lot of room for a focus on their pleasure. And actually they describe often, you know, faking pleasure, because it's their responsibility to kind of manage the ego of their male partner so that he feels like he's doing a good job. So they're kind of faking their pleasure. When actually in a heterosexual couple, if everybody's going to experience pleasure, then it's likely that they're going to need to spend more time communicating well about what feels pleasurable for the female.
Absolutely.
That's not the message they're getting from porn.
No, it's not. Just going over to the term explicit sexual material. So that covers porn, but it also covers a range of other things, doesn't it, in relation to the use of mobile phones, taking photos of yourself naked. That is a big issue too, isn't it, where that might be a spin-off, an arm from having a look at all of this pornography. And so men, a lot of boys, I should say, males pressure girls to send them pictures, but also vice versa. What's the situation there?
Yes, it's become a relatively common practice. And look, I think throughout human history, people have always used any technology that's available to us to explore our sexuality and to you know, to flirt, and whether it was a landline with a lead that, you know, many of the older listeners will remember from our childhood and adolescence. Then it's become the cordless phone that you could take to your bedroom and have that private conversation. And now it's, of course, a mobile device that is not just an audio device, but a very powerful computer in itself. So I think that it's not surprising that young people and adults are using the technology that's available to us to flirt, relate, you know, explore our sexuality. What's really concerning, I think, is that there's two elements of it that are concerning. And the first is where that imagery is created without consent or under pressure or coercion. Or, you know, we might actually want to think critically about a cultural environment in which there might be an expectation. So it might not be that a particular person is putting pressure on their partner to create a sexual image, but that there's this kind of socio-cultural expectation that that's what you do. So the production where there's any pressure or coercion, whether it's cultural or from an individual, I think that's problematic. And then the other part, and where there's greater levels of harm, is where there's non-consensual sharing of that sexual imagery. So whether the imagery was consenting or not in the first instance, it's then subsequently shared with other people for whom it was not intended. And we know that that is something that's occurring very frequently, and it's something that disproportionately impacts on young women who often are blamed for, you know, sharing the image in the first instance. And the people who've done that subsequent sharing without consent are often kind of not even in the frame. They're not considered, whereas actually the real harm occurs when it's shared without consent. Mm. We also know, I think, there are sort of increasing numbers of incidents of this occurring, not just between people who know each other and not just between people in the same country, but people who are kind of grooming children and young people to create these images online, not just adults, but other youngish people. Or they might be adults who are pretending to be young people, and it includes young men. So young men being filmed masturbating or being naked on camera when they think that they're engaging in a mutual consenting sexual interaction, but actually their imagery is being captured by someone who then intends to blackmail or coerce them, and leaving young people feeling really vulnerable. And, you know, I think one of the best things that we can do as parents or workers is to be very clear with our children and young people that we want them to talk with us and that we can manage anything with them. Because sometimes children and young people are getting so distressed by these experiences and thinking their parents will be so angry with them that they don't tell their parents or carers. And then they can get further and further caught, you know, sending money to people so they won't share the image, or creating more images so they don't share the first ones, and, you know, and getting deeper and deeper into these holes. And we really need to, we need some better systems in place to prevent that from happening. But we also need to be communicating well with our kids that we can support them. And the Office of the Youth Safety Commissioner that has, you know, great supports in place to support victims of these kinds of actions.
Yes, the website for the eSafety Commissioner is fantastic, and it has a whole section on dealing with pornography. So I suggest anybody to go onto that website. But before we go a little bit more to solutions, I just wanted to talk about that in relation to these images that are being sent, up to a third of kids aged or adolescent from, I guess, 13 to 16, males and females are pressured by their partners to send these images. And then over 50% of girls actually do it. And wow, I just think back to when I, you know, I'm 50 plus 10 now, everybody can add that up. But I remember when I was a teenager, so I'm a boomer, I received a phone call. I was about 16, and it was a question from a male saying, do you want, started with if, people can work out what that is. And I just dropped the phone, ran into my mother, And of course, this was well before mobile phones, and I just burst into tears. And I just think it's so sad. And I remember walking out the front of our house, you know, for the next week or two, thinking somebody was watching me. But I just think it's so sad for our kids and teenagers that they're having to grow up with this. And we as boomers, you're significantly younger than me, but you know, we as boomers have a responsibility, don't we? Because it was really only in the mid 90s that the internet really took off. We're only talking 25 years ago. So we had half our lives without the internet. Now we've had half our lives with it, more. And we have a responsibility, would you say that, to try and keep them safe?
Yeah, look, I think we do. I think parents and carers have significant responsibilities in that, obviously. We're sort of often the first line of defence on this. And schools have an important role to play as well. But it's also very unfair to leave parents and schools to tackle the influence of multi-billion dollar global industries, whether it's porn or social media or, you know, any number of other gaming industries. It's really very challenging, I think, for parents to put boundaries in place, to have the level of conversations that we need to be having to keep our kids safe. And I think there's a move towards and more of an appetite for some regulations that can, you know, support parents and others to keep young people safe. It's not a very good civil society when it's so easy for children and young people to access so much harmful content online, when big business has won the argument. Because we haven't actually had the argument as a society. It's like business has gone ahead of the sort of regulations that we might decide are good for, you know, a healthy civil society. Look, I just on the question around the sort of levels of production and sharing of personal sexual imagery, I think it is occurring regularly. There's a range of data, but I think that over half of sexually active teens in sort of year 10 to 12 have received or shared a sexual imagery. So the stats go up if they're sexually active young people. But it's also a significant portion of young people who are not yet sexually active, who have either had an image sent to them or shared a sexual image of themselves. And sometimes it's from pressure and sometimes it's just because someone wants to. And, you know, when it's fully consenting, then I would argue that there aren't harms involved, but it's certainly risky. It's risky because that image can be shared then with others without consent at a later time. So there are so many things that we need to be supporting young people to navigate safely.
So just going back to restrictions there or regulation, Marie, so are we talking about preventing these images, you know, pornography, from coming online to kids, say, below 16, or should we have some targets there? I know that it was tabled in Parliament not that long ago that we have restrictions on these pornography sites and producers, and they cannot target these young children. And there's ways we can do that by the ages of the person who owns the phone. What's the computer? What have you found to be really effective there, or should happen in relation to restrictions?
Well, there isn't currently a setup in liberal democracies like Australia where there is an age verification process in place, but the federal government has tasked the Office of the eSafety Commissioner with establishing an age verification, sort of a roadmap to age verification. And so I know they're currently working on that and speaking with stakeholders from all different angles and directions to work out what might be the most effective way to put an age verification process in place that protects privacy and security as well. So I think that the model might, for example, include third-party age verification. So the person who's wanting to access pornography verifies their age through a third party, not directly to the porn site that they're wanting to access, to maintain privacy and security. But then that third party can say, yes, they are over 18 and they can access it, or no, they're not, we can't verify that they are. And we also know, I think, that children and young people who want to will find ways to get around some of these kinds of obstacles that we might put in place. But there'll be a lot of children and young people who weren't intending to see porn and saw it unintentionally. So about half of young people are not looking for porn the first time they saw it. And this kind of regime could go a long way to protecting those young people from seeing porn.
And there's also a big difference. I'm so sorry, Marie. There's a big difference between trying to access seeing Frozen and having pornography come up on your phone. I mean, you couldn't get polar opposites there. So, and it's so harmful. So I'm sorry, I just wanted to mention that. It's just so unfair when these kids are just being so innocent, are so innocent, and all of this comes up. So yes, you're right. For those that aren't wanting to access it, at least where it doesn't come up inadvertently.
And also for those who are seeking it out, I think putting hurdles in place to make it more difficult will also limit how much they can access it. So it might mean that they're watching less of it, which we also know reduces their risks, or that they are actually not able to access it. And so it'll be very interesting to see what happens. The UK has been talking for some years about introducing age verification processes, and that hasn't happened there yet. There are other countries that are also talking about doing that. So it's a bit of a watch this space.
Yes, I was going to mention best practice in other countries. Is there a country that jumps out at you yet, or are they still all working on it?
They're all working on it. And I think Australia is one of the world leaders. You know, having a federal office of the Safety Commissioner is something that other countries are looking at and talking about and starting to implement themselves. I think Australia has been a bit of a leader in developing responses to online safety, to the dangers of the online world, but of course much beyond porn. My particular area of work is focused on mostly on pornography and its impacts, or gender-based violence prevention. But the eSafety Commissioner has a much broader remit than that, and it's fabulous to see that work being resourced and prioritised.
I wanted to talk with you about gender-based violence. As a sociologist, I've done a lot of work in that area. So how does a lot of viewing pornography can tip over into gender-based violence?
Well, we know that gender-based violence has one key driver, and that is gender inequality, and that there are higher levels of violence against women reliably associated with some particular expressions of gender inequality, if you like, which are things like rigid gender stereotypes, condoning of men's violence towards women, male peer relations and cultures of masculinity that emphasize aggression, dominance and control, men being in control and women's independence being limited. Now, pornography regularly depicts all of these things, and the consumption of pornography that reinforces those things as being normal, that it's normal for men to be in control in a sexual context and for women to be serving them, that it's normal for there to be gendered roles, whatever the genders, you know, of the people in it, whether they're both male, both female, male and female, that there's someone who's dominant and someone who is submissive. Those kinds of messages not only normalize violence against women, but they eroticize it. They suggest that violence against women is sexy and is a normal part of a sexual interaction. So I think that consumption of pornography is contributing to what we know is a global public health issue of really significant levels of gender-based violence and particularly violence against women.
Because it can tip over into other areas, can't it? We're not just talking about the sexual relations, but gender relations in every area, where if they see that this is happening between the sexes, and sometimes, you know, same sex, of course, then it can tip over into their gender relations in the home, caring for children, you know, where there we have this inequality of power and control. And we're looking at the coercive control so much lately, aren't we, with domestic abuse. So it can really tip over into a lot of areas.
Yes, and, you know, one of the things that's emerging in the recent research and in our interviews with young people is the prevalence of choking or strangulation during sex. And we've known for a long time that strangulation in an intimate partner violence context is a red flag for homicide. So you're something like 7 or 8 times more likely to become a victim of homicide from your partner if they've strangled you in the past. But pornography is normalizing. Pornography and some other parts of popular culture like social media memes and things are normalizing strangulation as part of a sexual interaction. And even if that only, it's incredibly dangerous, right? That the people that I've interviewed who are forensic medical examiners with expertise in strangulation say you can't do that safely. So young people are getting their messages about what's safe and pleasurable from porn and from, you know, social media influencers, not from medical experts. So that's one thing. But even if it was something that people did in the bedroom and didn't take out into the other parts of their relationships, there's still this incredible sense of power and the sort of reinforcing of that power inequality, because it is almost always, you know, it's mostly men doing it to women.
That's right.
So, and look, there's a range of studies, many, many studies and studies of studies, meta-analyses of research that find that there's an association between consumption of pornography and aggressive attitudes and behaviours towards women.
Yes. I wanted to ask you about the consent education now that's being implemented in high schools. Are we talking enough about the harm from porn with those education programs that are being implemented? Have you found that there is enough discussion about that? It's not just about having free consent and saying, well, you know, I need to make it clear to the female and she needs to feel she's got the ability to say no very easily. Are we talking enough about the dangers of porn?
Look, I think the answer to that is different depending on where you are. You know, it can vary between states and territories. It can vary between schools within the same state. It can even vary between the different classrooms in the same school. In some contexts, pornography is definitely talked about as part of conversations about healthy relationships, where we get our messages from, you know, being able to understand the characteristics of a healthy relationship versus an unhealthy relationship, and as part of consent education. And in other places, I think they are not yet talking enough about the kinds of influences that might be shaping the environment in which young people are negotiating consent. So it's great to talk about only saying yes to things you want to do and saying no to things you don't want to do. But if we're not addressing the real world influences that shape that conversation, including pornography and the way that pornography might be normalizing, you know, creating expectations about engaging in practices that someone doesn't want to do, but then you don't feel free to say no because it's what people think is normal. And young women talk often about this sense of, you know, being thought of as a prude or as uptight or vanilla. They call it vanilla shaming if they're not wanting to engage in things like choking, slapping, gagging.
Oh dear. Yeah, I wanted to talk about the double standard, because there's a double standard, isn't there, for males and females in relation to sexual activity. Can you explain a little bit about that?
So the sexual double standard is where young men get rewarded and, you know, viewed positively for being sexually experienced, and young women get viewed as, you know, get viewed negatively, get seen as the words like, you know, whore or slut or however they're understood. And for young women, actually, it's very complicated because they are seen as prudes if they are not prepared to engage in some things, and they're seen as, you know, whores if they are. I mean, they wouldn't use that language now, but I'm not sure what language.
So there's a hell of a lot of confusion, isn't there?
It's very mixed messages for young women. And look, I also think young men are under a lot of pressure, and the pressure may or may not be from a female partner. It might be from male peers. It might be from a male partner.
Yep.
There's it might be internalized. So it might be pressure that says, my penis needs to be this big. I need to be able to maintain an erection for this long. I need to perform as the in control, aggressive male character that I see in pornography. And if I can't do that, or I don't want to do that, then maybe there's something wrong with me. So I think pornography is selling problematic messages to everybody, really.
Totally. I was reading recently, and I mentioned it to you recently too, that a lot of males now, going back before the internet, there was ED, erectile dysfunction, with only a small number, about 5% of younger, you know, teens, early 20s. Now it's gone up to 30% because they think, oh, I've got to be in this scenario with my partner in order to be excited enough. And there is that problem too. So you're absolutely right that it can actually be a negative for a lot of males as well as females. So that's a very sad situation. I remember when I was a teenager, remember how you'd brush against one another's thighs and you'd think, oh, wow, you get a bit hot under the collar. Now it's, oh my God, we've got to have this scenario. And it's really tragic. It's very sad. So we have to pull that right back, don't we? And there's been a lot of desensitizing going on for teenagers, and we need to, you know, take those images away, as you said. So getting on to solutions now, you have an absolutely fantastic program in the picture that you've put together. Can I just ask you very quickly, what got you so involved in researching porn and preventing the harms around porn?
I was coordinating a few programs that were around young people and sexuality and relationships. One was a sexual violence prevention project, another was a sexual diversity project, and another was an STI prevention project. And over the years, young people increasingly spoke about porn being a place that they were learning about sex from as the internet became more and more accessible. But no one was really having the conversation with them, or they certainly weren't having conversations in the classroom. Many of them weren't at home either. And so there was really a sense that they were left to navigate pornography's influence alone. Mm. And I think that many of the adults in their lives, myself included, just had no idea the kind of content that they were exposed to. So the high levels of aggression. And so I remember having this conversation with a young man, with a group of young men who were talking about where they learn about sex from. And someone talked about, I asked, what did they learn from porn? If porn is one of the places they're learning about sex from, what are they learning? And this young man started, without words initially, doing a thrusting motion. And then it's like he put one hand on an imaginary shoulder of a partner and then punch into the air, saying,
oh no,
you stupid fucking bitch. I probably can't say that on the podcast, but swearing at his, you know, partner, and then going back to the thrusting. And I was like, wow, okay. So that's the kind of message that you get from porn. What do you do with that? You know, what do you think about that? Is that a good place to be learning about sex? And, you know, what would good sex be like? So really these conversations with young people prompted me and my colleague to initiate a project that was about developing education resources and also engaging in public conversations about pornography and the role that it's playing with young people to support more conversations and better education.
Well, having a look at it, this we're talking about In the Picture, the program, and I have to say I was absolutely blown away by it, and I want to see it in all schools, public, private, independent. Is that the plan? How is it being promoted across Australia? I think we need to talk to the Education Minister, Jason Clare, and just say it needs to go out ASAP. So how is it being promoted there, Marie?
I think people probably most often hear about it when they see me or hear me present at a conference or deliver training. I deliver a lot of professional learning for teachers, but also for youth workers, psychologists, police, doctors, you know, a whole range of professionals working in different sectors who might have something to do with young people. So I think that's most commonly how people learn about In the Picture. We're also on social media, on LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And we post regularly about these issues and also about resources that we've developed to support people to address these issues with young people. So people might find us there. And we have a website, itstimewetalked.com, which has information for young people, for parents, for schools and community organisations. So there's certainly information there about In the Picture, which was developed for use in schools, but is also used by a lot of community organisations or individual therapists. And there's a series of parent tip sheets. So there are 7 parent tip sheets that parents or anyone can download for free to give them some tips around things like, how can I start a conversation about porn with my child? My child's seen porn, what do I do? What do young people need to know and sort of understand about pornography? So, yeah, we've developed a range of tools to try to assist people to have the kinds of conversations that I think we need to have to help young people navigate pornography and its prevalence more, you know, safely.
Fantastic. And just finally, I just wanted to ask you, you've also got a great program called Talking Respect. And can you just explain a little bit about that too?
Talking Respect grew out of my work delivering professional learning about pornography in the Northern Territory. And any conversation about pornography in a classroom, in a community context, it really needs to happen within the context of broader conversations about sex, gender, power, aggression, media influence, online safety. And in my work with organisations like Women's Safety Services of Central Australia and the Tennant Creek Women's Refuge, we identified that it would be great to develop some resources that support that conversation about pornography, but in that broader context. So I conducted interviews with a whole range of young people, mostly in Alice Springs, around themes like, what's a healthy relationship look like? What's an unhealthy relationship look like? About the sharing of nudes, about social media, about jealousy, about pressure and consent, gender stereotypes, pornography, relationship violence, and develop some resources that draw on those interviews with young people. So there are little series of video clips with young people talking about those themes, and then discussion questions and quite a comprehensive manual that sits with that. And then there's another activity that's created through animations of little scenarios, little stories that are around some of these same sorts of themes that we developed with young people in Tennant Creek.
Wow, because that could be spread out really, can't it? You know, tweaked a little bit in relation to each state and territory. And to me, that could be spread out nationwide. And all kids, they love seeing, don't they, interviews of the people their own age, and they can really, it can really resonate with them what is going on for other kids their own age. So I think that would be really powerful. And that's called Talking Respect. And how can people have access to that?
Talking Respect, the resource is freely available on the website talkingrespect.com.au. So they can download the videos, download the PowerPoint presentations that have the videos embedded in them, and that 101-page manual that supports people to use it. And I'll also be delivering some professional learning in the Northern Territory later this year or next year to support people to understand the issues that are addressed in the resource, but also then to be able to use the resource in there with young people in their communities.
Fantastic. Wow, you're a busy person. And on that note, I just wanted to say thank you so much, Marie, for your time. It was great. We covered a lot of area there, didn't we, in relation to such an important issue, preventing harm around pornography. And thank you so much for all of your wonderful work. It really is fantastic. So thank you for your time today.
Pleasure. Thanks, Jane.
Next episode, I'm talking with internationally renowned forensic psychologist, Professor James Ogloff, about Australia's punitive prison system. In particular, we discuss the causes of our relatively high reoffending rate and the measures needed to reduce it as a matter of urgency for a safer and more humane society. Until then, take good care of yourselves and remember, knowledge is power.